KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the hour, Haiti is back on the front page, at least in the New York Times, our national newspaper of record, and it's not because of what's happening there right now. The Times has published the results of a huge investigation into the history of Haiti's forced payments to France, following Haiti's successful slave revolution and their establishment of the world's first black republic in the early 19th century. Amy Willens will report. Also, Hunter S. Thompson is credited with inventing gonzo journalism. He wrote a classic book about Nixon, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72. Peter Richardson will explain how he did it. His new book is Savage Journey, Hunter S. Thompson. But first, the fight to protect abortion rights has now moved to the states. And many states with clear pro-choice majorities can use initiatives and referendums to do two things: strengthen and broaden the right to abortion, and elect more pro-choice Democrats in November. For that, we turn to Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of The American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
So in The Prospect, you write that in swing states and congressional districts with pro-choice majorities, putting pro-choice initiatives on the ballot in November will surely boost the prospects of Democratic candidates. Explain how that would work.
Well, let's take California as an example. California already has a law allowing abortions, but it doesn't have that law or a similar law enshrined in the state constitution. So Governor Gavin Newsom and Democrats in the legislature are planning to put a measure on the ballot. This was by a process called referendum when the measure originates with the legislature that would enshrine that right in the California Constitution. Now, let's say, for instance, that you have a couple of swing districts in Orange County, which still has something of a libertarian bent. The Democratic candidates running in Orange County in those swing districts, and there were two of those districts that were won by Democrats in 2018 and then lost to Republicans in 2020. Well, if this is on the ballot, the Democratic challengers will say, well, we're for putting this in the Constitution. And this presents a bit of a challenge to the Republican incumbents. They will either support it and risk alienating, that segment of their base, which is adamantly anti-choice, or they will oppose it. And a lot of swing, suburban women who make up a very large component of the electorate in those districts could well say, well, screw you, I'm voting for the Democrat. And there are a number of districts around California where this is the case. Now, you can take it to a swing state, too.
And let me say, the target here is not only to win to the Democratic side some suburban women who are regular voters. It's to increase Democratic turnout, especially among young people who traditionally don't vote very much and certainly don't vote very much in midterm elections, because this affects them or their girlfriends or their wives or their sisters. And an increased turnout will also help especially will help the Democrats in these districts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Then you go to swing states where you can put ballot measures onto the ballot through, say, an initiative process. Well, let's take one such state next door to California in Arizona. Arizona is a state where the polling shows that supporters of choice outnumber opponents of choice by about 13%. Right now, the forces of, around the Democratic Party and the progressive groups who normally campaign for the Democrats, like the hotel union, are considering and mapping out what an initiative campaign like this would look like, in hopes of doing exactly what you just said, John, bringing out more young voters, establishing that right as a law in Arizona, and also helping Democratic candidates in a swing state where, in particular, there are gubernatorial and a senatorial seat that are up for grabs in November.
Now, my understanding is that in Arizona, signatures are being collected for a measure called the Arizona Right to Reproductive Freedom Initiative. It would put a constitutional amendment into the Arizona Constitution. I looked this up. 356,000 signatures are required to qualify, and the deadline to submit signatures is July 7th. The same kind of campaign is underway in Michigan, another swing state that we are really need to win, especially to reelect Governor Gretchen Whitmer. In Michigan, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU are collecting signatures for a constitutional amendment to establish a state right to reproductive freedom. There, 425,000 signatures are required, and their deadline is July 11th. Those are two of the most important swing states. Vermont also already has a proposal on the ballot. Proposal 5 would enact a constitutional amendment declaring an individual's right to personal reproductive autonomy. And in California, it's the legislature and the governor have to pass this initiative by June 30th. So we've got a little time to get that on the November ballot. We've called this a gift to Democrats. You think that's going too far?
In a word, no, I don't. I mean, it is you know, very good public policy in and of itself. Let's establish that it ensures a fundamental right. That said, if you look at the challenges of gathering signatures, among the groups that are investing in this in Arizona, I think the most important is the hotel union, Unite Here, the vast majority of whose members are women. I think probably more of childbearing age than not, because it's important because in 2020, when everyone else was doing their voter contact by phone or text or email or what have you, Unite Here put 400 canvassers on the ground for months and ended up knocking on 750,000 doors, 750,000 doors. They have the experience, they have the wherewithal to do this kind of signature gathering. And I think that's a major boost in the effort to put this measure on the ballot in Arizona in particular.
And they also have public opinion on their side. You cited the figures for Arizona. The national figures are very clear. A Gallup poll recently found that 80% of the American public think abortion should be legal. A Marquette poll found that voters opposed the Supreme Court overturning Roe by a 30-point margin. A CNN poll found that nearly 70% of Americans did not want the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. And a Washington Post ABC poll found that 75% of people say decisions on abortion should be left to the woman and her doctor. This includes 95% of Democrats, 81% of independents, and 53% of Republicans. Wow.
Wow, indeed. Yeah, this is, there has, in theory, been a strain of republicanism for a very long time that is libertarian. You look at Arizona, the above-mentioned Arizona, and Barry Goldwater, certainly, you can see that. You know, there's also one reason why I think young people are a particularly promising constituency for this is also really the very pronounced growth of secularism among the young. So you don't have a sort of ancient, theology, not rooted in anything other than patriarchal dominance, is affecting young people in large numbers. And so, no, there's a real chance that this will play a real role. Now, obviously, there are other factors in the November elections, things like inflation, which yes. cut the other way. So it's a bit of a guessing game as to how this is all going to go.
And the Republicans are very familiar with the polling figures. And so their tactic in the coming election is to not talk about their support for banning abortion and instead talk about inflation and Biden's lackadaisical presidency and failure to fulfill his promises. And as you have said here before, we'll see if that works.
Well, you know, I think there was that line during the Cuban Missile Crisis when the White House heard that there was one American aircraft up there that somehow had not been recalled from heading towards Russia. And presumably John F. Kennedy said, well, there's always one son of a bitch who doesn't get the message. And, you know, if you look around the country, there are some Republicans who don't get the message. Look at Oklahoma, just passed, is passing a law that would outlaw abortion, presumably from the moment of fertilization. I guess a little bell rings somewhere. You know, the Democrats are going to tout this. And there's, a number of such instances at the state level that they're going to point to. And they're going to point to the fact that in one of his rare, I think, tactical misstatements, Mitch McConnell said, well, yes, this could, it's possible that this could be brought up as a federal ban as well. Expect to hear a lot of that as summer recedes and fall emerges.
And it's true that many forces in the Republic, the evangelical Christians, their next goal is to get Congress to pass a national ban on abortion, not to leave it to the states, as the Supreme Court suggests that it should be.
Right. And, you know, there are some people who just don't get the message. And I'm sure Mitch McConnell and even the dim-witted Kevin McCarthy, want to shut them up, but they're not going to shut up.
There's a proposal to change or actually underway a change in the messaging on the pro-abortion side that is underway right now. Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and Equality Now are launching a new campaign defending abortion rights with a new argument. They've started running ads that say, end forced pregnancy. The argument is banning abortion forces women to remain pregnant against their will, losing control over their bodies and futures. I think the idea here is not to change the minds of the evangelical Christians who've been committed on this topic for, 25 years. It's to persuade supporters of choice who have not been particularly motivated to vote on this basis that it's time to take a stand, vote against forced pregnancy. I wonder what you think about that as a political message.
Well, first of all, I'm fairly confident, and this is purely an assumption, that if they're going with this message, they have already polled up the wazoo and found that it is more successful. I don't know how much more successful, but more successful maybe in getting public opinion sensitized to the implications of the court's decision. And in a sense, what it does, remember the evangelicals and the more theocratic wing of Catholics focus on the fetus. This puts the focus on the woman. And I think that's what this language and this ad campaign is all about. I don't know that it's going to affect things that much. I mean, I think what these ads make explicit is already implicit, but quite clear to most people. But, I think it might, might make raise the percentage of voters coming out to vote in a pro-choice way. It'll raise that by some percent. I don't think a lot, but definitely some.
And we could use some in Arizona, in Michigan.
Yes, these are all very much swing states. And these are all, these are all states like the rest of the United States in which President Biden's polling is around 40%. So the Democrats need something, and this is the only something right now that seems available to help their cause.
Well, elsewhere in politics, we have primary elections this week. We are recording this conversation before we know the results of this week's primaries, but there is one result we are very confident of, that in the Georgia governor's race, incumbent Governor Brian Kemp, who's being challenged in the primary by former Senator David Perdue, that Brian Kemp is going to win this one. And this has national significance because one key test of Trump's power with Republican voters is that he has made his number one target in the USA in the primaries, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp. Trump blames him more than anyone else for his loss in 2020. Trump personally persuaded Perdue to challenge Kemp in the primary, but Perdue has ended the race, low on cash, no ads on TV. Even his supporters say his campaign was lackluster and he's going to lose. And this is going to be, speaking before this event happens, the biggest electoral setback for Trump since his own defeat in 2020. This is the primary where he's worked the hardest. He recorded TV ads. He gave his own money, $2.6 million of his campaign funds, to groups to help Perdue. It's by far the most he's ever invested in another politician. And I think we need to contemplate for a minute, what does the defeat of Perdue in the Georgia gubernatorial Republican primary tell us about Trump and his influence on Republican voters, at least in Georgia?
Well, the influence is real, but it doesn't eclipse every other factor out there. And in this case, it certainly didn't eclipse the fact that Kemp basically has conducted himself in a way that most Republicans support, even if they take issue with his essentially upholding the verdict of the voters in 2020 in the state, that Perdue was a rather lackluster candidate to begin with. And then when you have a combination of those factors, Trump's support, however fervent it may be, may not be enough by a long shot. Now, Trump has even said, according to some accounts I've read, that in the November, when Kemp will presumably be running against Democrat Stacey Abrams, that he won't endorse, Kemp even then.
Wow.
Keep in mind, by the way, that Trump was so steamed at Kemp and Raffenberger, the Secretary of State in Georgia, that he said the election was rigged, and he discouraged his voters from going to the polls in the Senate runoffs in January of 2021, when John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won seats. Now, the nightmare for Republicans has to be that Trump decides he actually wants to discourage Republicans in Georgia from voting in November. You know, that would have the kind of consequences, it could have the kind of consequences that it did in 2021. And Mitch McConnell would once again wish Donald Trump were on another planet. But, Democrats can only hope that that's the case. We shall see.
Here's one more fact about Trump's number one target in the Republican Party. Mike Pence campaigned in Georgia for Brian Kemp. I believe that tells us something significant.
Yeah, this is a continuation of Mike Pence's sort of halting and slowly emerging declaration of independence. It may well be the case that Pence is actually planning to run for president in 2024. Another possible candidate, Ron DeSantis, who pretty much has become sort of the younger and somewhat less crazy version of Trump, DeSantis might actually be cowed at the prospect of running in Republican primaries against Trump in 2024. Pence is beginning to stake out a position that he might run anyway against Trump in 2024. So we shall see.
As I recall, the way Pence got to be Trump's choice for vice presidential candidate. This was a time when no one thought Trump had any chance of winning. Lots of people didn't want to be his running mate. Pence was going to lose his own reelection campaign in Indiana anyway, so he sort of had nothing to lose by tying his joining the Trump ticket. Doesn't seem like he's got enough political support to become president of the United States with that kind of beginning.
Well, he's also, I mean, you know, we're talking about a guy who's essentially a Christian fundamentalist.
Yeah.
On the one hand, the Trumpoids would never, I think, even in a runoff, vote for Mike Pence, who famously the slogan was they should hang him on January 6th.
He did, didn't they?
Yeah. So I think he carries the baggage of his one good deed to the Trump devotees and the baggage of every other position he's ever held to the Democrats and independents and the electorate at large.
Well, the only unfortunate fact about the defeat of Trump's chosen candidate in the Georgia gubernatorial race is that it's not particularly good news for Stacey Abrams. The polls show that she would do slightly better running against David Perdue than against Brian Kemp. Right now, the polls show her running behind by a few points. Of course, Republicans have gotten all the media attention for the last month because this really is a nationally important race. And there's one other factor that leads me to be more skeptical of the gubernatorial polls in Georgia. These are polls of what the pollsters call likely voters, people who vote all the time. Stacey Abrams' whole strategy for the last decade has been to change the definition of likely voters, to expand the number of voters, to recruit people who haven't voted before, to help them become likely voters. So I'm not sure the polls are measuring the extent of her support correctly here.
And if this is confined to people who say they're likely voters in this week's primary, well, obviously they're going to be a lot more Republicans because they have contested primaries, and the Democrats, primarily Stacey Abrams and Reverend Warnock, don't have contested primaries. That said, yeah, there's no question that she would do better against Perdue than against Kemp, but you can't always choose your opponent.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Harold, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Haiti is back on the front page, at least in the New York Times, our national newspaper of record, and it's not because of what's happening there now. The Times has published the results of an investigation into the history of Haiti's forced payments to France starting more than 200 years ago. It was an immense amount of money, which France said it deserved as compensation for Haiti's revolution and independence and slave emancipation at the time of the French Revolution. For comment, we turn, of course, to Amy Willens. She's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation and an award-winning writer about Haiti. Her most recent book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo. Amy, welcome back.
Thanks, John.
The reason we care about Haiti, we always remind listeners, is not only because it's a desperately poor country that's close to the United States, it's also because Haiti had the first successful slave revolution in world history, and because Haiti established the world's first black republic at the beginning of the 19th century. And then the French government required that Haiti reimburse France for the loss of its, what it claimed to be, its own slave property and land. This is not a news story, but I don't think it's ever been on the front page of the New York Times before. What is their focus? What is their central theme?
Yeah, it's barely been in the New York Times at all. Their central theme is how the Haitians, having prosecuted a successful revolution against Napoleon's armies, were then told by France and backed this threat, backed by French warships in the waters around Haiti in the, I think it was the 1820s, that Haiti would have to pay an indemnity to France, an independence debt, the New York Times calls it, for its successful revolution. This is the first time Haiti has many firsts, some good, some bad.
Yeah.
This is the first time the victor in a war has ever been forced to pay an indemnity to the loser. Obviously, the Haitian president, Boyer, at the time, did not have to pay that. But if he didn't pay it, he was being threatened with a renewal of battle against Haiti by France, possible victory by France, and a renewal then of enslavement of the Haitian people. He was also being threatened much more immediately with France's refusal to acknowledge Haiti's existence and thus with an impossibility of Haiti entering into world markets and having an economy of any kind. So he agreed to pay an astonishing sum of money to France.
And it took them more than 100 years to complete the payments.
It started in the 1820s, and it finally ended all of the payments, all of the interest through all of the banks. When Haiti ran out of money and had to have loans to pay France, it ended up in 1948. That's even in some people's memories who are on this show today.
Yes, it is.
And some not.
Thank you for that. So, and the New York Times connects this story of 200 years of massive payments by Haiti to France to the present situation. They write, "For more than a century, Haiti has been labeled a disaster, a basket case, a place so destitute, lacking, and lawless that it needs constant rescuing. The assassination of the president in his bedroom, the kidnappings in the capital, the Haitian migrants heading to the United States, they all point to a country in a seemingly endless vortex of despair that the world's great powers have not managed to fix. But the New York Times says the documents and financial records that we have reviewed show how much of Haiti's misery has been brought about by the outside world and how often intervention has been portrayed as a helping hand. Well, it really wasn't. Now, for a listener of our program, for readers of your book, for people who are historians of this period, there's none of this is news. So my question is, why is the New York Times doing this now? What is going?
Okay. First of all, I had to press my mute button while you were reading that so I wouldn't laugh out loud when you read it, because I'm very grateful to the New York Times for having done this. I think it's fantastic and wonderful that readers who were deprived for the entire existence of the New York Times from hearing what we have all known for so long are now hearing it from the New York Times, because when the Times says it, it then becomes true. Whereas when they refuse to say it, for all my 30 years of covering Haiti and longer, it isn't true. And who are the people who've reported that story in that way, by the way, that you just read from the New York Times? The New York Times. So, and others, of course. I don't single out the New York Times, but they're the paper of record. They take the lead. They're responsible in great measure for Haiti's trials and tribulations being reported without historic context, especially without the context of this giant indemnity to France that I certainly have been talking about for a long time. And I did not discover it, nor did I ever thump my chest and say how great I was to discover it. No, I found out from Haitian historians that this was the case from reading their books. They write books in Haiti. You would not know that necessarily from the New York Times, from reading all their books and scholarship. I learned about this, and I'm grateful to the Times for having gone after it.
Yes. Why?
Okay.
Why, given their long history of ignoring this story, has the New York Times decided to make amends, to reverse course?
I have some theories about this. Let's thank George Floyd for his great sacrifice,
good,
first of all. George Floyd is now, as far as I'm concerned, a martyr of the Haitian Revolution. Without Black Lives Matter, this story would not be reported the way it's being reported.
Excellent.
That brings up some questions, of course, as to further reporting by the New York Times. Note, it was Ta-Nehisi Coates' story on reparations that did not appear in the New York Times, but appeared in the Atlantic. The New York Times has some explaining to do to Black Lives Matter about why they're not publishing a piece on Black Americans' right to reparations of this great length and this great historic research into how much is really owed and what it means. But we who study Haiti are very grateful, and we're grateful to George Floyd.
So let's look a little more closely at the reporting that the New York Times is running all week in the print edition and in a gigantic piece on the website. The first is called The Roots of Haiti's Misery, Advancing the Thesis, which they have finally decided to
has some merit.
Make amends for their past failures. The second section is called How a French Bank Captured Haiti. What's this one about?
So that's about the French banks and how they, first of all, they dealt with the indemnity. It's just so hard to understand how this would happen in those days. This was the first time, actually, a poor country paid a debt to a rich country also. You could look at it that way, just paid off money the way the Third World, as it used to be called, had to pay off money to the International Development Bank and the World Bank over years and years. So it wasn't that the Haitian government had these giant coffers filled with gold that they then gave to France. It was little ladies in the countryside. They had to, every time they paid for something, they had to bring their pennies to pay for this indemnity, to pay for basically being having the right to their own bodies, to put it in blunt terms. And the French banks recouped all this money. And as the money ran out and the little ladies and the men of Haiti could no longer pay their little monies, Haiti had to take out loans to finish paying off this indemnity. And those loans bore interest, and they had to pay off the interest. And that's where how the French banks came to own Haiti after the French had owned Haiti. And one of the really interesting things in the piece is how so much of this money at the beginning went to the people in France who had actually lost their plantations. So they owned Haitian land, they owned Haitians. Then when the revolution came, they were paid off through this indemnity, and they made millions of dollars off this indemnity. And their descendants, most of them had no idea when the New York Times found out who got the money, had no idea that this was where their great fortunes came from, so that they have a castle in, you know, the Alsatian countryside, a castle in the Loire, a mansion outside of Paris. They didn't know that it was off the bodies and the blood of the Haitian slaves. They just thought, oh, we're rich.
And then the next section of the New York Times is titled, Invade Haiti, Wall Street Urged, the U.S. Obliged. What's that one about?
That's about how the American banks also participated in this, what I would call massive global blood-sucking of the Haitian Republic. And their banks, the National City Bank especially, came into Haiti along with the National Bank of Haiti, which was really an extension of the French banks. And it too offered loans to Haitians and then added interest to those and added to this horrible burden that the country could never get out from under. And when anyone raised a voice about this in Haiti, the Americans didn't like it, and they wanted to make sure that nothing would interrupt this continual flow of funds. And so indeed, they did invade Haiti. The American Marines, partly, one hears from the New York Times and has heard in the past, at the behest of Wall Street and the National City Bank.
And then the last section is titled, Demanding Reparations and Ending Up in Exile. Who was it that ended up in exile?
I love that title. It's Jean-Bertrand Aristide. It's one of those things where papers like the New York Times liked to brag at the time Aristide was first elected in the first free and fair elections, monitored with the help of American President Jimmy Carter, about how great the United States was in bringing free and fair elections to Haiti. Yet twice Aristide was ousted for power because he was progressive and outspoken and irritating. And once under the man I like to call Papa Bush, and once under the man I like to call Baby Bush, after the dictator François Papadoc Duvalier and his child, the Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier. But the reason that last bit is called asking for reparations and ending up in exile is that Aristide, in his second permitted term, brought world attention to the independence debt, the unfairness of it, and the amount of it. What would be owed to Haiti by France? What is, in fact, morally owed to Haiti by France? And how much it is? And he had a whole team of researchers, not unlike the team of researchers of the New York Times, do a study on how much that would be in today's dollars.
And then what happened to Aristide after he proposed that France should repay Haiti for the reparations?
He was ousted. The French ambassador went to his house, and an American diplomat went to his house, and they told him he had to leave. They said, well, you could stay, but there's a coup d'etat being planned against you. We don't know if you'll survive. They said, write a letter of resignation, which he didn't exactly do. And then they stuck him on a plane and he ended up in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Anyway, in the heart of Africa, unlike his predecessor in being ousted by the Americans, Jean-Claude Duvalier, who ended up in Paris. I'm just saying.
Well, the Times does have a long essay on sources of the sort of conventional historical kind of the dozens and dozens of books in English and French that they consulted. They claim, I think correctly, that the most original part of their investigation is the new effort they made to calculate the amount of money that Haiti actually paid France and their creditors. Let's talk about the amount of money that they came up with. How much does the New York Times say Haiti paid to France and their creditors?
It's something like, in today's dollars, $41
billion. $41
billion. Billion, not million, billion.
B as in baby. Mm-hmm. How does this number compare with the number that Aristide came up with?
Very close. The New York Times acknowledges. Very close. In fact, he may have underestimated a little bit compared to what they found. However, you know, for all the chest beating, they only came up with pretty much the same number Aristide came up with. But I don't want to take away from the New York Times having done this story. I think it's great. It's grand. It's respectful. It's the right thing to do. They perhaps didn't acknowledge all their sources. Everybody in Haiti is complaining about that, and I understand that. And to Haitians, it just seems like unfathomable that the New York Times could be declaring this to be a really new, interesting piece of information when they've known it their whole lives. So,
but of course, what Haitian knows is not the same thing as what Americans know. And that's why we're talking about this now. And
right.
The New York Times then concludes with speculating and talking to people about what Haiti could have been like, what Haiti could be like today if this $41 billion had remained in Haiti. So let's talk about this alternative history of Haiti.
It saddens me a lot to even think about it. I mean, some money would have been stolen, of course. Every government has a right to steal some money.
Okay.
But, you know, there would have been money that could have been invested in, first of all, infrastructure by Haitians building their own infrastructure instead of the American occupation forcing enslaved Haitians to build the kinds of roads the American sugar growers needed in Haiti. There could have been money spent on healthcare instead of having, you know, one ophthalmologist per every 1 million people in Haiti. There could have been money spent on education so that there would be more than one ophthalmologist for every million people in Haiti. But these monies were never spent. They were never had. And it would have made Haiti an independent country instead of cultivating this sick dependence on foreign aid and the kindness of strangers, which is never very kind.
One other thing, the Times website about Haiti's debt is a gorgeous and wonderful thing to look at.
Yes, they've done a wonderful job. First of all, the photographs that they've run, I've never seen before. And I thought every photograph ever taken of Papa Doc Duvalier, they have two I've never seen before. So that means you're looking at something quite special. They have photographs of some of the documents that they found documenting this debt. They're incredible. And one of the things they've done that I really appreciate, aside from just running the whole thing, is in some places on the digital version, they've kind of simplified their argument. And that's great because people can look at it easily, see what it means. They don't have to read the whole damn thing unless they're like me. And that's fantastic. I appreciate the simplification. And the other thing they've done, which I love, is they published it in French and in Haitian Creole without a paywall. So, okay, we people in America have to pay the paywall, but the French don't and the Haitians don't. The only little problem that I'm sort of trying to push buttons about is I'd like to have an audio version in Creole because a lot of people who speak Creole don't read Creole. Even if they read French, they don't really read Creole. So I think that would be a great thing to have on the radio in Haiti is the New York Times version of this story. I mean, that might change things.
So the kind of explicit message here is summed up in the word reparations. The New York Times does not approach this as on the one hand, on the other hand. Some people say reparations are justified. Other people aren't so sure. Their conclusion is there's $41 billion that France and Wall Street owe to Haiti. We've never really seen anything like this from what we call the mainstream media, I don't think.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it raises so many questions, but they do seem to come down on the side of let France pay. But then doesn't it raise the issue of reparations in the U.S. and let the U.S. pay? It doesn't really, because they're very clear without saying it, that this is not about the slaves' labor. This is not about what they produced for France. This is simply about the independence debt. It's a very separate thing. Black Americans did not pay an independence debt. Once they were freed, they were freed to try and live in this crazy country as best they could live. But we do owe them reparations for having built the country, just the way France also owes Haitians reparations for having built the country as well as having paid for the revolution. So it's a very mixed bag that the New York Times is kind of avoiding one side of the whole discussion while saying France should pay its reparations, and it should.
Amy Willens. Her award-winning recent book about Haiti is Farewell, Fred Voodoo. Amy, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Now it's time to talk about Hunter S. Thompson, the man who invented gonzo journalism. Of course, he lived in that famous fortified compound in Colorado with his guns and his drugs, and he wrote the classic book before that, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. For that story, we turn to Peter Richardson. He's written wonderful books about Kerry McWilliams and about Ramparts magazine. We talked about them here. His new book is called Savage Journey, Hunter S. Thompson and the Weird Road to Gonzo. Peter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, we have to start with Hunter S. Thompson at The Nation, way back in 1965 when he wrote his breakthrough piece that led to his first best-selling book.
Right. Thompson was in San Francisco. He had been attracted to San Francisco mostly because of beat literature. He wanted to investigate what was happening in San Francisco. He was working as a freelancer and he was not thriving. And he basically wrote a letter to Kerry McWilliams at The Nation begging him for an assignment. And McWilliams suggested that he write an article about the Hells Angels and the motorcycle gangs in general. Thompson thought it was a splendid idea. He rode around with the Hells Angels for a couple of weeks and submitted the article, which ran in 1965. And on the strength of that article, he was able to get some book contracts. And Hells Angels became his first best-selling book. It came out in early 1967.
And who was Hunter S. Thompson before that? How did he get started as a writer?
Well, he grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. He served in the Air Force and was a sports writer there. Bounced around a little bit. He was in Puerto Rico. He did some foreign correspondence for the National Observer in Latin America. Then he returned to San Francisco and was writing for the National Observer there. And he split with them. He wanted to do things a little bit more like Tom Wolfe. He wanted to review one of Tom Wolfe's books. They weren't interested. He wanted to report on the free speech movement at UC Berkeley. They weren't interested in that. So he decided to try some new outlets, and that's how he ended up working with Kerry McWilliams at The Nation.
My favorite writing of Hunter S. Thompson's is his reporting on Nixon in the 1972 campaign, which was glorious. He called Nixon a born loser, capital B, capital L, quote, the predatory shyster who turns into something unspeakable, full of claws and bleeding string warts on nights when the moon comes too close. That's from Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 72. How did Democratic strategist Frank Mankiewicz describe Hunter S. Thompson's coverage of the 72 campaign?
Yeah, he described it as the least factual and most accurate description of that campaign, which was very shrewd insight. He really understood what Thompson was going for there and what he achieved.
And who gave him that assignment? How did it work out? It seemed like a problematic one. Hunter S. Thompson, at that point, lacked the experience, lacked the access, lacked the resources, and didn't have any status as a political reporter, where the other people covering the campaign had been doing this for years and decades.
Yeah, he was by no means a typical member of the campaign press corps. By that time, though, he had written Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which appeared originally in Rolling Stone magazine. Rolling Stone was based in San Francisco. It was a rock magazine, but it was always more than a rock magazine. And the co-founder and editor, Jan Wenner, thought this would be a great assignment for Hunter Thompson, fresh off of that success, for a couple of reasons. And one of the main reasons was that the 1972 campaign was the first one in which 18-year-olds could vote. So that was a natural demographic for Rolling Stone magazine. And Jan and Hunter thought, maybe we can move the needle a little bit if we feature campaign coverage from Thompson in this kind of freewheeling style in the pages of Rolling Stone magazine.
The book that resulted, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 1972, has become a classic of political journalism. In The Nation, you identified his five most relevant lessons for journalists today. For starters, most political writers rely on inside sources to find out what's really going on. That's why we read the White House Corps reporters for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so on. And those people spend years cultivating their sources. That seemed like Hunter S. Thompson's biggest weakness.
Was a weakness. He didn't really have anybody on the inside that he could go to. He also didn't have any colleagues to use as a sounding board or support his work back in the office. He had Tim Krause, who did a fantastic job and wrote his own book about the campaign press corps, The Boys on the Bus, that was also ran in Rolling Stone and was a big success. What he did have was a unique opportunity, though. And by that, I mean, he didn't need to cultivate sources because he wasn't coming back. So his idea was, I'm going to offer the readers of Rolling Stone the unvarnished truth, as I understand it, not only of the candidates and their campaigns, but also about the other media outlets that were covering the campaign, their blind spots, their prejudices, their limitations. And so in that sense, he was empowered to do something that no one else could do. And it came naturally to him anyway. That's what he wanted to do. And so he quickly turned what seemed like a weakness into a strength.
But journalism has rules, and getting the facts right is number one. Accuracy is our highest obligation. And if you're a political reporter in the 60s or the 70s, you're supposed to avoid partisanship and advocacy. And of course, that was not the way Hunter S. Thompson worked or wrote. What was it he said to an editor about facts?
Yeah, he said at one point in a letter that facts are lies when they're added up.
Facts are lies when they're added up. Wow.
Yeah, it really means that it's not obvious that just getting the facts right is going to get you to the truth. That there are some truths that are more accessible through fiction, for example. And, you know, he really wanted to be a novelist even before he became a journalist. And I think he really understood the power of fiction in that way. And he blended fiction and hallucination and invective and satire into this kind of powerful combination, along with the hyperbolic political commentary. And that, I think, is what made his, what he called his jangled campaign diary, probably the most durable and certainly the most memorable account of that campaign.
The reigning king of campaign journalism in 1972 was Theodore S. White. He had written the classic book, Making of the President 1960, about Kennedy beating Nixon. Was a huge bestseller, won the Pulitzer Prize, and then became a franchise. He wrote a Making of the President book then every 4 years. People loved these books because they read like novels. White told a dramatic story about a hero overcoming huge challenges. What was Hunter S. Thompson's approach?
You would think he might have pursued something like that because it was so successful and he did want to write novels, but he decided not to go that route. In part because it disguised some of the things that he wanted to say about the political class and about the campaign. He had no desire to make these politicians look any better than they actually were. And that was a kind of built-in tendency, I think, of Theodore White's approach. It made the victorious politicians look heroic. And that was never any part of Hunter Thompson's plan. He did admire some of the politicians, especially George McGovern, but he really didn't like Edmund Muskie. He didn't like Hubert Humphrey, and he absolutely detested Richard Nixon. And, you know, when Nixon lost in 1960, White made him look not so good. White actually went back and apologized to Nixon before 1968 for that coverage. Well, as it turned out, Thompson's much more critical assessment of Richard Nixon, you know, looked prophetic after Nixon's presidency went down in flames shortly after the election.
Of course, the clearest element of Hunter S. Thompson's style was hyperbole. Nixon is the predatory shyster. That's hard to sustain, especially in a book-length work, especially in a career. Let's talk about hyperbole.
Right. Hyperbole you do want to avoid if you're a traditional reporter. It's really the last thing. You don't want to be hyperbolic. You don't want to go overboard. You're trying to get the facts straight and the proportions right. Thompson went the other way with it, and you have to be careful with hyperbole. I mean, with Nixon, comparing Nixon to a werewolf, for example. Yes. I mean, what do you do with when Reagan comes along? You've sort of cut down on your possibilities there. But in the right hands, hyperbole can be really good at lifting a topic, raising a topic excessively to reveal an undervalued truth. And that's what Thompson was going for. He was not trying to mislead his readership. He was trying to get at a truth. But he realized that to hit that mark, he had to overshoot it.
And the other key element here is that Thompson always put his own emotions front and center in his writings, which, of course, is a taboo for political journalists. How did he do it?
Well, for one thing, he never hid his own preference for George McGovern from the beginning, even when McGovern was not leading in the primaries. He was behind Edmund Muskie and Hubert Humphrey. So Thompson was, from the beginning, obviously for George McGovern, whom he really admired. It didn't prevent him from criticizing McGovern. But the point was that he was straight with his readers about where he was coming from. And that allowed his readers to make a critical assessment of what they were reading. You didn't have to be a McGovern supporter to understand what Thompson was trying to tell you about that campaign. And the other thing was that you think of Thompson as being this kind of confident, swaggering person, but really what he was doing was kind of exposing his feelings here in a way. There was a kind of humanity that came out through that coverage, and that took a certain kind of courage. And some later readers, including Matt Taibbi, said that was really the key to the success of that coverage, is that he was kind of exposing himself emotionally in a certain way, in a way that most readers didn't expect. And I think that made it more moving than it would have been if he had covered it in the campaign in the traditional way.
Your piece in The Nation, Five Lessons from Hunter S. Thompson, seems like a kind of a guide. It makes me think, well, maybe I should try to write like Hunter Thompson. I imagine the same thing has occurred to you, but I notice your book is not a work of gonzo journalism.
No, and I really wouldn't recommend that kind of slavish imitation to anyone. Very few people have been able to pull it off. I mentioned Matt Taibbi. He did about as well as you can do, not by imitating Thompson, but he was clearly influenced by Thompson. The thing about Hunter Thompson is he had a long apprenticeship, both as a fiction writer and as a journalist. He knew exactly what rules he was breaking and why. And I think if you look at Thompson and you think, I'm going to do what he did, I'm going to get high, I'm going to stomp on my own accelerator, and then I'm just going to write whatever comes into my head, that is probably the best way to misunderstand him and his achievement.
Peter Richardson's new book is Savage Journey, Hunter S. Thompson and the Weird Road to Gonzo. You can read his piece, Five Lessons from Hunter S. Thompson, Wisdom from the Godfather of Gonzo, at thenation.com. Thank you, Peter. This was great.
Thanks for having me, John.
That's it for today's Living in the USA. Our sound editors are Will Broughton and Alan Minsky. Our social media maven is Renee Reynolds. KPFK's programming traffic director is Matt Perez. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you miss part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at livinginTheUSApod.com. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.